Kid, we didn't have andouille in New Orleans until later. He also introduced culinary flights of fancy such as Cajun popcorn, a real novelty at the time. Run by the Brennan family, led by matriarch Ella Brennan, Commander's Palace, following the French lead, began touting Prudhomme's food as Nouvelle Creole. They had a point. Cajun food was the marriage of French technique and Louisiana product and soul. Prudhomme began to catch the attention of writers, such as James Villas, who profiled him in a cover story for Bon Appetit, a rare Bocuse-worthy bit of publicity for an American toque. In 1979, Prudhomme and second wife Kay Hinrichs, a former waitress he'd met when they both worked at Maison Dupuis, opened Kay Paul's Louisiana Kitchen on Charter Street in the New Orleans French Quarter. The restaurant was cash only and had only 64 seats. It was also a money machine, costing only $50 per month in rent, which included tables, chairs, a counter, bar, and full kitchen, and turning the tables four or five times per night. Prudhomme continued to work at Commander's Palace, enlisting Frank Brigston, a former Louisiana State University student and apprentice from Commander's Palace, to be his chef. There were no recipes. Menus were created in late-night confabs and by phone during the day. When Prudhomme would call Brigston and describe something as radical as crab meat hollandaise, with enough lusty detail that the latter could successfully whip it up on the fly. Having the chef from Commander's Palace, one of the fancier places in town, running one of the most casual, dinner ran a mere $5 or $6, was cause for a double take. Brigston believed Prudhomme did it for love, and also to create a place where his family could feel comfortable when they came to town. Eventually, he left Commander's, but not until they found a young, unheralded chef named Emeril Lagasse to take his place. Kay Paul's was, in Prudhomme's own words, a dump. It had communal seating, wobbly chairs and tables, and blue plate specials. Kay was a character, and the restaurant was run in her image. No reservations, no credit cards, no wine list. If you wanted the food, you'd wait in line and pay cash for it. And if you didn't finish your plate, you were probably going to get yelled at, remembered Brigston. Chef was the cook, said Mary Saunier, a former Kay Paul's cook. But it was her restaurant. I don't care what anyone tells you. The kitchen was his, but the restaurant was hers. The demand for tables was enormous. 100 people would be queued up at opening time, and they'd seat 60 people at once, get slammed. Prudhomme was a true original. Though he hewed to principles of Cajun cooking, the restaurant's repertoire was distinctly his. Both were noteworthy. People hadn't considered the idea of a regional cuisine as he was presenting it, said Michael Batterbury, founding editor of Food and Wine, which brought Prudhomme to that Tavern on the Green event in New York City, where he met Alice Waters in 1979. Prudhomme's insistence on fresh ingredients was also new and drew purveyors his way. Farmers from as far away as Mississippi brought livestock and produce to his door. One, Dan Crutchfield, arrived with everything from fresh rabbits to peanuts to edible flowers. Prudhomme's cooking elevated ingredients like tasso and boudin to national attention. When Prudhomme went on Today for the first time, he demonstrated how to make jambalaya. One of his brothers was outraged, called him to ask how he could cook trash food on national television. Cajun food at that time wasn't a source of pride. It was the shameful food of the poor, though Prudhomme was rapidly changing that. In March 1980, Prudhomme introduced one of the first of what would become known as signature dishes to America's culinary lexicon, blackened redfish, made by dipping fillets in butter, coating them with a mixture of cayenne and dried herbs, and searing them in a skillet. The dish's popularity literally threatened the population of redfish in the Gulf of Mexico, prompting Prudhomme to eventually limit the number of orders per table at Kay Paul's. A prototype of the dish was born at Commander's Palace, when somebody's offhand reference to campfire-cooked fish led Prudhomme to experiment, greasing redfish with butter, seasoning it, and cooking it on the flat top used to keep large pots warm. He wanted to put it on the menu, but Ella Brennan insisted on a grilled version, not blackened. At Kay Paul's, he did the fish in a cast-iron skillet, and it became a sensation. Prudhomme became a national celebrity, and his gregarious personality and imposing physical stature He was exceptionally hefty and bore more than a passing resemblance to the comic actor Dom DeLuise, a major star of the day, made him a television natural. The summer following the AIWF Stanford Court dinner, he would take his show on the road, like the Malmaison can experiment years earlier. It was yet another ahead-of-its-time iteration of the pop-up concept in San Francisco, in a kitchen-outfitted nightclub arranged by concert promoter Bill Graham. The promotion sold out its entire 4-week run, despite the fact that it didn't take reservations. People waited in line for up to 12 hours for a table. In the year following the dinner, in 1984, long before it was an expected step for an American chef, Prudhomme published his first cookbook, Chef Paul Prudhomme's Louisiana Kitchen, and would go on to create and market a Magic Seasoning Blends line of spices that required a 30,000-square-foot plant to meet the worldwide demand for the product.
Can't you get lamb in California?
An American Celebration was perhaps the purest distillation and greatest expression of Michael McCarty, who summoned all his producer-like powers to will it into existence, creating an unprecedented happening. An 8-course tasting dinner, each course prepared by a different chef and, perhaps even more audaciously, paired exclusively with wines from American vineyards. The goal was nothing less than to announce to the world that American food had arrived, and to underscore the continued development of wine production in the United States since the Judgment of Paris 7 years prior. Finding Jimmy Schmidt at the London Chop House, that was through James Beard, because this guy named Lester Gruber owned the London Chop House, and he was really into American food, recalls McCarty. Hallmark had a restaurant called Harvest or American Cafe or something in their headquarters. It's still there, I think, as a restaurant. Bradley Ogden was the chef there, before the American restaurant. We only knew Prudhomme by his reputation, of him doing blackened redfish. That was me reading about the guy who was changing Creole and Cajun food and making it modern. Who in Northern California is creating modern American food, says McCarty. Okay, Alice at this time was beginning to shift. You had to do Chez Panisse. She was a big part of us. Jeremiah Tower had his Santa Fe Bar and Grill. Mark Miller had 4th Street. He was doing the first of Latin, of Southwest. He was the first guy to really begin to use peppers, jalapenos, and all that stuff. Those were the three from Northern California. Jonathan and me in L.A., Wolfgang because he had just opened Spago, and pizzas were a big deal. Of course, some of the chefs already knew each other. Waxman and Forgione had met at brunch at the River Cafe. Waters had been to River Cafe, and Waters and Prudhomme had bonded at that food and wine event at Tavern on the Green. Prior to that dinner, Alice, Paul Prudhomme, and myself kind of had a little alliance amongst ourselves, says Forgione. We did talk regularly. We shared a couple of things. Things were so disconnected at this time that Schmidt didn't even know his closest geographic colleague, Ogden, with whom he was to collaborate on a course. So they connected by phone to begin planning their dish. Okay, we've got to do a bunch of Midwestern stuff. And he said, yeah, I'm from Michigan. And it was right at that time of year in May. It's like, hey, we can get morels. We can do lamb. And I said, I've got a great source of lamb. This guy who raises lamb in Michigan. He raises petit pois for the Green Giant. The lamb would clean all the fields, so it's really sweet lamb. He said, that's cool. So I sourced the ramps and the morels and all those ingredients and shipped them out. And then Bradley and I got together and did all the prep work together and knocked it out. We shipped everything on the plane to get it there, and obviously that's a hell of a lot of lamb. So we were schlepping all this stuff around trying to pile it into cars at the airport. And they're like, what's in the box? It's lamb. Can't you get lamb in California? I thought it was really cool, because using the local indigenous ingredients from Michigan made a lot of sense. And that was kind of the direction my food was going. Using all these local things that I'd seen in France and formulating how I was cooking and what the guests were eating based on foods in season that taste the best, that are the best for you. Probably instinctually what you crave anyway. So we got out there, worked through the Stanford Court. That's like one big mother operation type of thing. The Stanford Court held a special place in the emerging culture of American gastronomy. The hotel's founder, Jim Nasica, and his lieutenant, Bill Wilkinson, were known as patrons of the culinary arts. Jim Nasico was a founding board member of the AIWF, and that's why it was with Robert Mondavi, and that's why it was held at the Stanford Court, because it was a close relationship with the Mondavis and the hotel, says the hotel's longtime pastry chef Jim Dodge, now director of specialty culinary programs for Bon Appetit Management Company. That's where all the chefs would stay for their culinary events coming into San Francisco. Beard also regularly stayed there when visiting the Bay Area. If Creating Michaels was a caper movie, this event was a heist picture. Every month for a year, McCarty flew to San Francisco for an AIWF board meeting and to plan the dinner. To accompany the food and wine, McCarty enlisted his friend Paul Gurian, producer of Cutter's Way and other films, and a frequent dining companion, to work with him on a series of videos introducing the chefs, and in many cases their dishes, to the audience. One thing that impressed me right from the beginning, says Forgione, was that I had a sense that this was going to be a spectacular evening by the fact that Paul Gurian was producing the video that went along with it, that they were going to such lengths to capture the chef and his surroundings, and we were going to be staying in a world-class hotel. We were going to be cooking for the Julia Childs, the Bob Mondavis, the Dick Graffs, all the people that you had heard about and read about and met through your restaurants. You just knew that all the people in this event, whether they were cooking, serving, or dining, were all in a community together. In a cosmic coincidence, that same month, Food and Wine published what it dubbed the Honor Roll of American Chefs, a hall of fame of Americans in pro kitchens who were changing the industry, one of the first such lists ever published, which included the Stanford Court's own Jim Dodge and most of the chefs participating in the dinner. Mark Miller was relegated to the also noteworthy category, along with Susan Feniger, Mary Sue Milliken, and Leslie Refson, who was listed as a chef in transition. It also featured Ken Frank, who was by then ensconced at Le Toque on Sunset Boulevard, but there was no mention of the reclusive Bruce Martyr. In a public relations coup, the issue also featured recipes from Haywood and Ryan's menus at American Bounty at the Culinary Institute of America. The honor roll remains a fascinating document that illustrates how quickly people cycle through the industry. It's also a tribute to the power of celebrity. Most of the chefs who didn't participate in the dinner have faded into obscurity, though a few remain in the national, even international, consciousness. To Waxman's point about people having the same experience around the country, each in their own way, many of the honoree stories mirrored those of the AIWF participants. Among several others, there was Patrick O'Connell, who had opened his inn at Little Washington in Washington, Virginia. There was Robert Kincaid, then working at Harvest Restaurant in Cambridge. There were Jasper White and Lydia Shire, listed as a team, at Seasons Restaurant near Boston's Faneuil Hall. From Los Angeles, there were Michael Roberts and Le Saint Germain's Patrick Healy. For all his success and influence, Wolfgang Puck, born in Austria, wasn't included on the honor roll. Neither was McCarty, who, alas, wasn't a chef. It's happening! We're doing it! The dinner was set for May 4, 1983, a Wednesday. The chef started arriving the day prior. The hotel, no stranger to hosting industry heavy hitters and ambitious events, nonetheless hummed with anticipation. I remember the planning and the detail, says Dodge. It was extremely exciting. However, none of us in the kitchen really understood exactly what was going to happen to have that many visiting chefs in that kitchen, which was a good-sized kitchen. We always had a big staff because of the focus on the service and the quality of food we served. But to have 20 or 30 extra bodies in that kitchen and have camera cables throughout the kitchen and big cameras, it was amazing. Absolutely amazing. Jim Nasica was one of the greatest hosts in America, says Forgione, who thinks the trip might have been his first to California. Anything he was involved with was done over the top. Not only had most of the chefs never met, many of them didn't know anything about the other's food. As they materialized, in addition to sniffing each other out, they also marveled at what the others were cooking. As each person arrived, they were bringing food with them, remembers Forgione, who prepared his tureen of three American smoked fish with their respective caviars in New York and flew it in, leaving only the sauce to be made in San Francisco. So you would be there checking your stuff and rewrapping it and getting it put away. And next thing you know, Jeremiah would be floating down, and then somebody else would come down. I was picking up techniques and seeing what other people were doing, says Schmidt. And there they were, the emerging titans of a new American cuisine, gathered in one room, a kitchen, no less, for the first time. Larry Forgione, Mark Miller, Bradley Ogden, Jimmy Schmidt, Jeremiah Tower, Alice Waters, Jonathan Waxman. Also present, if somewhat incongruent, was restaurant consultant Barbara Kafka, whom McCarty had invited to participate at James Beard's request. She prepared tripe gumbo for the after party. Before you knew it, you were having a party in the kitchen, says Forgione. Wolfgang Puck, the biggest chef of the moment, was absent. At least two major historical accounts place him at the dinner, but he wasn't there. Remembers Mark Peel, who attended on his behalf. Spago was not given a course at the dinner. We were doing the pizza at the after party, and Wolfgang was pissed. I think it was because, now Michael McCarty may deny this, but my feeling was that Spago was the big, hot ticket in L.A. at the time, and Michael was a little pissed about it. So it was like him saying, yeah, you make pizza. So Wolfgang was annoyed, but he wanted to be involved in the dinner, so he sent Ed Ledoux and myself, and we made pizza for the after party. Video of the event shows Peel and Ledoux representing Spago to Julia Child on camera during a post-dinner kitchen curtain call. I thought perhaps the reason might be that Puck wasn't American, but when I emailed McCarty to ask why the pizzas were relegated to the after party, he wrote back simply, wanted to have something really easy, casual, and fun after the big meal. Schmidt remembers his first impressions of the group. Waxman was earthy, Berkeley, laid back, even in the kitchen. Forgione was serious. Ogden was impressed with his skill and, as a fellow Midwesterner, was the closest temperamentally to Schmidt. Miller was spicy, very effervescent. He's just bubbling and he's got 10 million ideas going 100 miles an hour. Tower was theatrical, very well-spoken, very high society, even in the kitchen, and already had the disposition of a star. Waters was granola, laid back, really about the ingredients, really very focused, but not overly animated. Even at that point, Schmidt described her as iconic, at least in my mind. And Schmidt's impression of McCarty? He sums it up in one word. Armani. An American celebration. Dinner menu. 4 May, 1983. The Stanford Court, San Francisco. Reception. Cultured Olympia oysters from Puget Sound, Washington. Belen oysters from Tamales Bay, California. Portuguese oysters from Vancouver Island, British Columbia. Schramsberg Vineyards, 1977, Reserve Napa Valley Champagne. Tureen of three American smoked fish with their respective caviars. Larry Forgione, River Cafe, Brooklyn. Jordan Vineyard and Winery, 1981, Estate Bottled Chardonnay. Red pepper pasta with grilled scallops. Jonathan Waxman, Michaels, Santa Monica. Chalon Vineyard, 1981, Estate Bottled Chardonnay. Garden Salad, Alice Waters, Chez Panisse, Berkeley. Sanford Vineyards, 1982, Vigne Gris. Blackened Redfish, Paul Prudhomme, K. Paul's Louisiana Kitchen, New Orleans. Beringer Vineyards, 1980, Private Reserve Chardonnay. Marinated grilled quail with poblano chili, cilantro, and lime sauce. Mark Miller, 4th Street Grill, Berkeley. Iron Horse Vineyards, 1982, Sauvignon Blanc. Roasted rack of lamb, stuffed with Missouri greens and hazelnuts, gratin of wild root vegetables, fiddlehead ferns, and cattail sprouts. Bradley Ogden, American Cafe, Kansas City. Jimmy Schmidt, London Chop House, Detroit. Acacia Winery, 1980, Pinot Noir, St. Clair Vineyard. American Cheese Selections. Robert Mondavi Winery, 1974, Private Reserve Cabernet Sauvignon. Pecan pastry with chocolate and sabayon sauce. Jeremiah Tower, Santa Fe Bar and Grill, Berkeley. Balboa Cafe, San Francisco.
Joseph Phelps Vineyards, 1981. Chauray, Late Harvest.
After Hours Party. Spago Pizza. Wolfgang Puck, Spago, Los Angeles. Domaine Chandon Blanc du Noir. Tripe Gumbo. Barbara Kafka, Star Spangled Foods, New York. Christian Brothers Private Reserve Centennial Sherry. An American celebration was a service like no other. When the night of the dinner arrived, McCarty, the ringmaster and master showman, gathered the chefs in an ancillary room and ran through the logistics with them. He was brimming with pride at every aspect of the evening, even the fact that computers were used to check people in. "We were trying to accomplish many different things at the same time," says McCarty, still underscoring the then novelty of a computerized check-in system that allowed staff to print table assignments by keying guests' names into their system. Each table was a 10-top. Molly Chapelet did the floral arrangements. They weren't flowers. They were fruit. Absolutely spectacular what she did. "She has a degree in art," says Dodge of Chapelet, who designed special flourishes for culinary events at the Stanford Court. "So what she did at her home in the winery, because she's a phenomenal gardener as well, she liked to bring the outdoors inside. So for table arrangements, she would bring in a head of cabbage and peel back the leaves and create it so that it was a beautiful arrangement. And she did that at that event. On every table, there was a vegetable that she arranged in an artistic form. Alice was just absolutely amazed. She said to her, 'I've always thought these things were in themselves beautiful, this produce, but I just didn't know how to incorporate them onto the table like that.'" A few hundred food aficionados gathered in the dining room to see and taste for themselves what was transpiring in restaurants around the country. In the moments before the dinner, distractions mounted along with the pressure. There were journalists on hand, and many of them made their way through the kitchen during prep, prompting Schmidt to think, "We're going to get our asses kicked. I just said, it's time to put our heads down and get this thing done, because we're not going to get all this lamb through all these ovens. I think it's very flattering, but I've always been of the mind of put it on the plate. Let the food talk." After the kitchen work was done, plates were shuttled to four production tables in the dining room, where they'd be finished, then shuttled to guests by the service staff. Between courses, the videos were shown. The shorts are cheesy but charming and capture, in many cases forecast, the iconic images these chefs would attain. Alice Waters is depicted strolling her garden, gathering greens for a salad. Jonathan Waxman, dressed in a woolly sweater, grills scallops on a mountaintop while, no joke, Chalon Vineyard's Dick Graff flies in and lands a small aircraft within shouting distance of him. "What are you doing?" Graff asks Waxman from the cockpit. "I'm grilling scallops for my scallops and red pepper pasta dish," says the chef. "I've got just the thing to drink with it," says Graff, holding a bottle of his vineyard's Chardonnay aloft. Since his services weren't required until the after party, Peel was free to act as a floater, working with the other chefs, getting a first-hand knowledge of their food by helping them prep it. "Alice's course was salads, so I got to plate all the salads. I got to do black and red fish with Paul Prudhomme. We had all of these big charcoal grills out on a fire escape. They had pre-alerted the fire department that billows of smoke were going to be coming from the Stanford Court. They didn't want people calling in. We had to put the cast iron skillets right on the coals to get white hot, and they double-dipped the red fish in clarified butter. And then this heavy, heavy spice goes on it. Then it gets dipped again. Then it goes into the white hot skillet, and I was nearly poisoned from these billows of smoke. Paul Prudhomme was larger than life," remembers Schmidt, "and he was doing black and red fish, which was the big craze in the world at that time. And he was cooking it outside on this balcony thing, and I thought that was pretty cool, because he was dipping the fish in butter, and the fish was cold. So the butter would congeal, and he would hit it in the spices and do it." "He almost burned up the joint," says Ogden. The chefs learned almost as much as the diners. "It was just surreal," says Forgione. "I remember how hard everybody worked and how much everybody helped each other. It wasn't, My course is done. I'm going to go get a glass of wine. Waxman provided extra support to Barbara Kafka of Star Spangled Foods, who was recovering from meningitis. I said, Barbara, I have your back, says Waxman. Whatever you need, I will take care of it. She was literally on my shoulder the whole night. I said, don't worry. I will do all of the heavy lifting for you. You just look good, girl. That was my job. It was very special. We all cooked together that whole dinner, says Waxman. Every course we cooked with each other. It was the coolest thing in the world. We saw what each of us were doing. It was all different, which was the coolest thing. Some were more classic than others, and some were more crazy than others. That was the sort of culminating moment when we knew that it was a codified American food scene. What that meant, we had no clue. But we knew that even though we were all from different parts of the country, we had this very strong bond. We were all trying to change the landscape of what we do. I think that was bar none where American food started, says Ogden. It was really acknowledging that we have good cooks in America. And to represent America, represent our sort of history, where we were up to that point in our culinary works. It was the start of something bigger than we envisioned. We had no idea. We were just cooking. Not everybody was enchanted.
Well, I mean, we accomplished something, says Waters. That we did. But it was a lot of cameras and lights. It felt very Hollywood to me. It felt a little surreal. I just don't feel sentimental about it. Although I felt like I was always cared for by this group of chefs. They've always been my friends. I love that. I was the only woman, but I was their pal. And I loved that they sort of took care of me. I felt like I could count on them.
One of the journalists on hand was the omnipresent Ruth Reichel, who says of the evening,
I was back in the kitchen. And even my editors, when I pitched it to them, it was like, oh, come on. You can't get a bunch of chefs together. It's going to be a nightmare. We all thought it would be. I mean, today it's so obvious. Of course these chefs all work together. Nobody had ever done anything like that. I just remember it was lighthearted in a way. And the AIWF wasn't lighthearted. Every program had been very serious. And so to me it was the chefs taking over from the Bob Mondavis, Julia Childs, the Jim Nasikas, and this young spirit coming in. Because people were still thinking of the food business as people who were in competition with each other, nobody thought that this was going to work in any way. In the spirit of camaraderie, I mean, it could have been a nightmare, and it wasn't. It was at the Stanford Court, which was very proper. And it was just an event that was not like anything anybody had done before, in that sense of how much fun it was, how lighthearted it ended up being.
The de facto main course, the meat course, came up. Ogden and Schmidt's collaboration, which was ambitious enough without the added burden of putting out several hundred dishes.
We were struggling just to get it all pushed through, all that lamb, says Schmidt. And it was new for Bradley and me to work together, so it was kind of just like, let's figure this out. Let's show them what we can do here. And we did. There were plenty of steps in the dish. We had taken all these herbs and stuff and turned it into a stuffing and put it inside the morels. There were multi-layers of flavors and au gratin potatoes and reductions.
In the heat of the moment, Schmidt looked up to see Waters, Tower, and other new friends arranging his and Ogden's food on plates, bringing their dish to life.
Everyone teamed up. There was a whole sense of, not competitiveness, but actually camaraderie, working together and everybody plating food together. We really hadn't seen that before, with people you had just met. It was amazing how it just all accumulated.
Once he and Ogden got the last lamb dish out, Schmidt, who had only really tasted a few canapés and Prudhomme's blackened redfish, stood back and took it all in.
The quality, the plates that were coming up, the dishes that were being made was world class. The meal was fabulous, compared to sitting in a 3-star restaurant in France. He didn't have to be over there anymore to have that experience. That's what my takeaway was. That what was going on those plates, the quality of the ingredients, the style, the culinary technique, the shared philosophies of people working together, was world class. We had entered having a cuisine that could actually be deemed powerful enough to represent the country and not feel ashamed that we're a second-class food nation.
It's happening, Schmidt thought to himself. We're doing it.
At the end of the meal, an ebullient Julia Child interviewed the chefs for the camera. Then came what has become a de rigueur element of any chef-fueled charity event. The after-party.
It's a really wide range of personalities, says Schmidt. The foundation, or the glue, was that that group of people had reached these conclusions of cooking in a certain direction with American ingredients almost separately. We kind of came to the same place. And we also, funny enough, did it not because we were going to get our name in the paper. We did it for the purity or the value.
And there was an added benefit. We put out the dinner and then it was party like crazy, says Schmidt. After everybody left, there was another room that was set up, says Forgione. For the chefs. If I remember correctly, it was basically the whole party came into the after party, or a good portion of them. Certainly the people that were also serving wines at these dinners, or donated food, or were producers of the food. We had the best fucking time, says Waxman. We were drinking champagne out of the bottle. We were laughing our heads off. That whole 2 days were just celebratory, says Forgione. We were truly celebrating American food, American drink. During the post-service release, the chefs also had time to absorb the night, to replay the food they'd witnessed and helped each other prepare, to realize the magnitude of what had happened.
You felt like you were part of a history-making dinner, that this was going to begin something, says Forgione. This was going to begin a tremendous movement. I think it reinforced what everybody was doing by seeing everybody else that was doing it. And it wasn't that you were doing it better than somebody else. It was just that we were all doing it. We all loved what we were doing. It was so exciting. We all wanted to work together. You feel like now there's other people to talk to, says Forgione. There's people who want to know about your free-range chickens. And I want to know about Paul's soft-shell crawfish. And the bounty of things that are in California.
Ogden gravitated to some chefs more than others. In Forgione, he saw a kindred spirit.
Shy, sort of like I was. We just hit it off. When I got talking to him, he sort of had the same background as me a little bit, even though he came from the New York area. And his style is more French than my style. Mine is more American because it's the way I was trained. That's the way I grew up. But we became the best of friends.
Seeing what each other was up to was an empowering moment for these chefs. The crowd was split between chef owners such as Prudhomme, the absent Puck and wife partner Barbara Lazaroff, and Tower, who was already hard at work on Stars. The others all were essentially employees, but they began to see in that weekend a blueprint for the future, a time when chefs could call their own shots, perhaps own their own restaurants.
I realized that it was time for me, says Waxman. I was done working for someone else. It was time for me to go and be my own chef, stake my little claim.
The dinner also changed the trajectory of Ogden's career, leading to talks with Campton Place Hotel's Bill Wilkinson that would bring him from Kansas City to San Francisco.
That day was the beginning of so many careers, says Ogden.
It was time for me to get out of Detroit, says Schmidt. Who ended up partnering with McCarty on the Rattlesnake Club in Denver, Colorado.
He was looking for a chef, and I said, I'll do it.
Moreover, the chefs were keen to stay in touch, to collaborate again, and, whether it was stated or not, to take advantage of the power inherent in their numbers. Chemistry played a huge role in the evening's impact. Though the group comprised people of different economic, geographic, and social backgrounds, a sort of culinary version of the Avengers, somehow they meshed.
We could have hated each other, says Waxman. We could have been what chefs used to be, standoffish and secretive and protective.
Everything the dinner foretold came to pass. The chefs became the core group that represented and lorded over the industry for years to come, the go-to interview subjects for the proliferation of national articles on new American cuisine, and the people who were creating it, as well as the nucleus of large-scale fundraising events. An early example that endures to this day is City Meals on Wheels, a charity created by Gail Green and James Beard to deliver meals to homebound elderly in New York City.
Many of the chefs also participated in Wolfgang Puck's unrelated Meals on Wheels charity fundraiser in Los Angeles.
I did 30 years of those dinners with Wolfgang, says Schmidt. I was there from the first year out. I didn't piss anybody off, so I got through it.
Before leaving the Stanford court, though, spare a thought for Mark Peel.
I had a different experience because I was helping everyone during the day and during the service, he says. The after party was when I was working my fucking ass off. Everybody else was partying and drinking their champagne, but I was turning out pizzas like a machine gun. I didn't have the luxury of time to gaze out over the crowd and have this epiphany.
Peel was living out one of the truisms of the chef's life, working while others are celebrating. He was also a metaphor for one of the themes of this era. Those forging this new world were often so consumed by their work that they didn't realize how far they'd come until well after they'd arrived.
6. California Dreaming?
I like to see a little cooking for my money.
Alan King. How Jonathan Waxman brought California cuisine, if there is such a thing, to New York City, driving a stake into the heart of diners' expectations, while East Coasters forged their own new American style, confusing, then erasing, distinctions between East and West. You're not supposed to light a Weber grill indoors, but there was Melvin Master, firing two of them up in the open kitchen of his restaurant on East 79th Street on Manhattan's Tony Upper East Side. It was only a few weeks into 1984, and Master and his chef partner, Jonathan Waxman, were all set to introduce California cuisine to New York City at their hotly anticipated Jams, starting with a preview benefit for City Meals on Wheels. The party was just hours away, but the Montague Grill Waxman had specially ordered had been stalled by a snowstorm in Pennsylvania. No grill meant no California, hence the Webers. Master positioned them under the ventilation hood, loaded them with mesquite, lit them. Within an hour, Waxman and his cooks were pumping out past hors d'oeuvres. Everything went swimmingly, until the extractor fan gave out. The room filled with smoke, and people's contact lenses were bulging out of their eyes, recalls the British-born master. Finally, we got it under control and everyone was fine. That was the birth of Jams. Improvising had always worked wonders for Waxman and Master, and it would continue to work for them, until it didn't. Though short-lived, Jams left a deep footprint, exporting California cuisine and a California management style to New York City. Along with a handful of other chefs who came east in the mid-1980s, and a smattering of Manhattan restaurants created in the California vein during the same period, the moment would forever blur the distinctions between chefs on different sides of the country.
There was nothing like it in New York.
Did it all start in the fall of 1979? As Waxman might say with a weary sigh, who the fuck knows? Master thinks it did. As sales director of Sonoma's Jordan Winery, he enlisted Michael McCarty to put on a guest dinner at the vineyard, flying up McCarty, his chef Waxman, and sommelier Phil Reich. Master and his wife, Janie, high school sweethearts from across the pond, had known McCarty when they all ran restaurants in Denver in the mid-1970s. But it wasn't until Michael's that they met and became friendly with Waxman. Both guys were, says Master, posse boys, and we were all doing that kind of stuff that we all did back then. The Jordan dinner was such an A-list affair that People magazine was on hand to document every sip and nibble. Waxman gave hostess Sally Jordan fits. When she asked to see a menu that morning, he told her his muse wouldn't clock in until after lunch and a few glasses of wine. Properly lubricated, Waxman began cooking that afternoon, while McCarty, taking charge as usual, gave the winery staff, Mexican women costumed in frilly French-style black-and-white maid's uniforms, their hair hugged by bonnets, a crash course in front-of-house elegance. The evening was a triumph, betraying none of the haste of its preparation, or maybe because of it. McCarty didn't revere top food writers the way many of his California peers did, as evidenced by an incident that took place during dinner prep.
Sally Jordan comes up to me and says, Mike, there's someone on the phone for you, recalls McCarty.
He took the phone, and the caller introduced herself.
This is MFK Fisher. Would you guys like to come over for lunch?
I had no idea who MFK Fisher was. I thought it was just one of the crazy rich people up there. I said, listen, we're really busy. We have this big party tonight. I'm really sorry, but we just don't have time. Goodbye. Boom. Pantomimes hanging up the phone. She lived right around the corner. The Masters and Waxman grew close over the ensuing years, dining around the States, traveling to Paris. Waxman was one of those chefs who left the AIWF dinner at the Stanford Court Hotel, itching to strike out on his own. California was home, but New York City fascinated him, especially Lutèce, which he still had a crush on after all these years. He almost doubled down on McCarty, who was eager to open a Michael's in New York City, with Waxman on board as his bi-coastal chef, possibly even a partner. But McCarty, who insisted on a backyard garden to conjure the California spirit, couldn't secure his dream space on West 55th Street in Midtown Manhattan. Meanwhile, the Masters, who owned a stately home outside Litchfield, Connecticut, planned a gargantuan New Haven seafood restaurant to be christened Billingsgate after the London Fish Market, but couldn't cobble together the backing. Mel found himself on the phone with Waxman, never lacking for an opinion, who told him New Haven was crazy. They should open a restaurant in New York City. Intrigued, Master invited Waxman to come on board. Timing is everything. With the McCarty deal stagnating, Waxman said, fuck it, and decided to partner with the Masters. And so was conceived one of the seminal American restaurants of the 1980s. Evolution was swift. The fish eatery mutated into a shared vision of a restaurant that would package light, leafy California cuisine in a bleached white box and plop it down, incongruously, into the concrete canyons of Manhattan. Billingsgate was shed in favor of the name Jams, an Americanization of confitures, as well as shorthand for Jonathan and Melvin's, or Janie and Melvin's, semi-jokes the other Master. The idea, says Master, was to bring a Michaels-type restaurant, Jonathan's food, California cuisine, to New York City. For good measure, they poached Michaels pastry chef, James Brinkley. Waxman had a vision for the kitchen and the food. Not unlike Puck, he would eschew the European model that dominated New York City, the chef's toque towering like a skyscraper, knotted neckerchiefs, a cacophony of whirring blades throughout the prep day, clanging oven doors and pans during service. Those tradition-bound restaurants were fundamentally concerned with transforming ingredients. The California school preferred to fetishize their natural state, or as close to it as could reasonably be sold in a restaurant, and the kitchen would reflect that. I wanted to have a wood-burning grill, which I never had before, says Waxman, and I wanted to have no machinery. I had no robot coupes or Cuisinarts. I wanted that rusticity. As for the food, Waxman planned to draw heavily on his menu from Michael's, a document whose DNA included genomes from McCarty's time ghosting Jean Bertrenu. Not going anywhere was the chicken. I wanted to make my own French fries the way I had learned in France, and I wanted to buy the best chicken I could possibly get. Buddy Larry Forgione, by this time at an American place, put Waxman onto Paul Kaiser's free-range chickens, and to so many other purveyors that Waxman joked that Jams should have been called another American place. Master was in perfect sync with his partner. There was nothing like it in New York, says Master. No one had mesquite grills. No one had open kitchens. No one had baby vegetables. The Masters and Waxman rented a $400 a month one-bedroom apartment in the West Village. Waxman, who'd come to town with a Ferrari, a wardrobe, and nothing else, crashed on the sofa. The trio beat the pavement looking for a space until, driving across East 79th Street one day, they spotted one for lease, a restaurant on the lower two floors of a townhouse. An extracted pipe left a 3-foot sag in the dining room, but they would have accepted a dirt floor because there was no down payment required. We didn't have any money, says Waxman. Master summoned an old friend from the L.A. restaurant scene, Larry Shupnick, who in turn corralled Marvin Zeidler, who would go on to become Bruce Marder's partner in Santa Monica's Broadway Deli and other ventures. The two came to New York City, saw the space, and said, "You're both insane, but we'll back you." Those were the little ideas that I had in my head. Like so many chefs of his generation, Waxman had taken his sweet time finding himself and the professional kitchen. Trained as a trombone player, he had chops enough to earn a scholarship to the University of Nevada and gig with the likes of Sammy Davis Jr. But food was always in the background. In the late 1960s, after returning from Nevada to his hometown area of Berkeley, he moved in with a woman whose parents were passionate foodniks and treated the young lovers to expensive dinners. Waxman left the relationship with a foundation in fine dining that complemented an innate weakness for luxury. He joined a band in 1970. Rather than eat in crap restaurants on the road, the musicians threw spontaneous dinner parties that descended into back canals, cooking out of a copy of Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking, passed down to Waxman by his mother. Like many contemporaries, Waxman had discovered food, in large part, thanks to Child, Graham Kerr, and Gourmet magazine. Back in Berkeley, Waxman took, and loved, a class with Le Cordon Bleu's Richard Grossman at a local department store before moving to Maui to study politics at the University of Hawaii. After dropping out of school and a quick stint with yet another band, he found himself stranded far from home and penniless. "There are two things you can do," counseled a friend. "Sell drugs or work in a restaurant." Waxman chose the latter, securing a job on Kanapali Beach. It was one of these restaurants with a huge bar that served daiquiri cocktails and snifter glasses, and the cocktail waitresses wore basically nothing, says Waxman. It was right on the beach, open air with a canopy above. People grilled their own steaks and swordfish. My job was to prep all the meats in the morning and bus tables at night. Within 6 months, I was the manager because I smoked less pot than everyone else. Returning to Berkeley in 1972, Waxman led a triple life. By day, he donned a pair of Gucci loafers and sold Ferraris and Alfa Romeos. By night, he played in a jazz band and tended bar. Between customers at the auto dealership, Waxman gabbed about food, prompting the owner's wife, a food lover, to recommend her friend Mary Risley's San Francisco cooking class. This being Berkeley, the shop's head auto mechanic matriculated with Waxman, who proved a natural. After the last days of class, Risley approached him, asked what he was doing with his life. "I don't know," said Waxman, then 25.
"Why don't you think about going to cooking school to become a chef?" she asked.
The thought had never occurred to him, but it made perfect sense. Risley secured him a spot at Paris's Le Varenne. His parents put up the tuition, and on his birthday, November 15, 1976, he touched down in Paris. He can still taste the duck confit and garlic potatoes he ate on arrival. A Paris virgin, he spent 6 weeks learning French at Alliance Française, befriended a fellow student, a photographer, and ended up rooming with the shutterbug, a colleague of his, and two fashion models. Then he dove into cooking school, compares it to dropping acid. He couldn't get enough. Instructors and the French media were obsessed with the kings of Nouvelle Cuisine, and Waxman lapped it up. He and some friends rented a dilapidated Opel and made a gustatory tour, dining at Trois Gros, Bocuse, and other Michelin starlets. The zeitgeist prompted a barstool epiphany.
"What if we took all the sort of classic regional foods of America and did what they did in France?" he thought. "Lighten them up. Make them more accessible. Make them different somehow."
"I didn't know what that meant, really," he says.
"What if, instead of having a big slab of abalone cooked in butter and flour and put on a plate with more butter, you took that abalone and cut it into strips and deep-fried it and tossed it into a salad to wilt the salad?"
Those were the little ideas that I had in my head. Those were the things I tried at Michael's. "It would be an honor and a privilege for you to work for me." In Woody Allen's Annie Hall, released in 1977, protagonist Alvy Singer, a New Yorker, orders alfalfa sprouts and a plate of mashed yeast at an outdoor L.A. cafe. Gothamites erupted into peals of laughter at the line,
a bite-sized summation of the East Coast's perception of the California diet. How things had changed in 7 years. New York food writers and diners anticipated jams with "The circus is coming" giddiness, and many young cooks, most of them trained in French kitchens, wanted to work there. In an era when there was scant national coverage of chefs, their reputations and legends grew like gunslingers by word of mouth, and Waxman's had already swelled to tall tale status. Forgione, now at his own An American Place, sent his former cook, Helen Chardick, there to meet his buddy from California. She interviewed in the unfinished space. "It had wires and light bulbs, and the toilet was sitting in the middle of the room, and it was completely undone. But he was going ahead, and he was going to open anyway," says Chardick, who, having done time in California, saw through the clutter. "I knew exactly what he was doing with that grill. I knew exactly what he was doing with his food." Ralph Tingle, who'd cooked for Wolfgang Puck at Ma Maison before coming to New York, and had admired Waxman's work at Michael's, had left Le Cirque after a tiff with Elaine Sayoc. He strolled into the jam space one day, asked Waxman for a job, got hired on as sous chef. Ed Fertig, another River Cafe grad, also interviewed at the construction site. Waxman ended the tete-a-tete, saying, "It would be an honor and a privilege for you to work for me." Fertig found it pompous, but figured there had to be talent behind the bluster. The legend grew before he'd served a morsel of food in Manhattan. Journalists, too, wanted a piece of the action. New York Magazine's Gail Green contacted Master about a pre-opening piece, insisting on a photograph. The restaurant was still under construction, so it was improvisation time. "Janie goes next door to Rosedale Fish Market," says Master. "She buys some scallops. Jonathan buys some greens, brings them back. Janie takes her eyebrow pencil out, paints black lines on the scallop to look as if it had been on the grill. Jonathan does his magic putting the things around it, and voila, we have what looks like amazing grilled scallops with little baby greens." That was the photo that went into New York Magazine. In January 1984, the month before the restaurant opened, Marion Burroughs penned a New York Times piece titled, "Food Accent for the 80s is Decidedly American, a Summation of the Action to Date." The emphasis on fresh ingredients, the rediscovery and reinterpretation of American dishes, the proliferation of chef-farmer relationships, and the transmission of inspiration from major market to major market. She also traced the movement's echo in the fast food and supermarket realms, and predicted an uptick in Oriental and Mexican influence. In the piece, she observed that chefs were opening their own restaurants instead of going to work for others, citing In American Place's Forgione and Waxman with his about-to-launch jams as role models. When the restaurant finally opened in February, the dining room could have been plucked right from Santa Monica, a minimalist space with chalk-white walls hung with outsized modern paintings procured by Waxman and floral arrangements created daily by Janie Master. There was a petite, freestanding, antique, zinc-topped Parisian bistro bar with a walnut facade. Tables were set with blue-rimmed white Ginori china. The kitchen was, of course, open, barely set off from the dining room by a butcher block-covered Trollson pass-through refrigerator that served as the pass. To avoid a Siberian stigma, the upstairs was decorated to evoke a clubby setting. In exclusivity, Master would offer the anticipated celebrity guests. Ironically, given Master's wine acumen, they had yet to secure a liquor license, requiring customers to bring their own in the restaurant's first days. The food was everything people had been primed to expect, and more. There was, of course, the chicken. There was a shiitake and oyster mushroom salad with pine nuts and Smithfield ham. There was sautéed foie gras with deep-fried spinach. There was swordfish with blood orange and shallots, and veal with veal stock and limes. There were also Californians. Several West Coast peers were in town around the opening, including Puck himself, who dropped in for lunch. The restaurant took off fast, despite some good old-fashioned New York attitude. George Barber, former front-of-house man at Michael's, came to New York City, ran into Waxman on the street, and took a job at Jam's. There was a stay-in-California thing among these tough New Yorkers, remembers Barber.
New York was different in the 80s. It was a lot more cynical. It was a lot more territorial as well. They did a big thing coming from California.
Waxman picked up on it, too.
New York had no idea what I was doing, he says. So when I opened up, they were like, what the fuck is this? Where does he get off grilling chicken and serving it with French fries? Where does he get off serving sweetbread salad? Where does he get off serving wilted mushrooms?
They all kind of loved it, and they were kind of confused by it at the same time. But everybody seemed to take it in stride.
I think Gail Green legitimized a lot of it, says Barber. She started City Meals on Wheels, and I think Jonathan was the first one that really helped her, and he got a lot of cachet from that.
With Waxman plying his trade in New York City, the legend went full supernova.
Jonathan would come into the kitchen and gather up these ingredients and create this plate. It was almost like he was dancing, remembers Stephanie Linus, who cooked at Jan's. And that's the way the food was. It was very fresh, simple, alive feeling, and certainly a la minute. Everything was just coming off the grill.
Tingle found the food lacked the elegant twist that Michael's had. It was more stripped down, more organic, which he attributes to Waxman's time at Chez Panisse. Accordingly, he was knocked out by the ingredients Waxman was able to secure.
It was the first time I'd seen vegetables coming in from these organic farms, like baby carrots, and they were rock-solid fantastic. We had chickens coming in with rigor mortis, with the feet on and the head on. Jonathan was a pretty good forager. He was finding some pretty unique things to bring into the restaurant, and how we treated them was pretty darn simple and straightforward. We weren't making coq au vin through marinades or sauces or whatnot. We were taking this chicken that's beautiful, organic, fresh, and grilling it and putting a little rosemary on it.
Tingle, charged with ensuring certain standards like a crispy skin on the chicken, understood the inherent risk in Waxman's approach. Simplicity leaves nothing to hide behind, so you really have to do a good job with it.
The grill was hot as shit, remembers future Quilted Giraffe cook Tom Carlin, who came to Jams from 40 Main Street, a contemporary American restaurant in Millburn, New Jersey, where Tom Colicchio also worked early in his career.
It was like working in a coal mine. I'd come home and blow my nose and it'd be black. And if you were standing in front of the grill and then moved your arms forward and your chef's coat hit your back, it would burn you.
The minimalist kitchen called for unconventional techniques. The fries were made in a pot on the grill, rather than in a fryolator. The oil sometimes bubbled over, causing fires. The laid-back vibe extended to the plating.
He didn't want to arrange the food, says Carlin. His words were, don't move things around. I want it to look like it just fell from the sky and landed gently on the plate.
The price tag for such simplicity raised eyebrows. The chicken and fries were $20 on opening day. For comparison, it debuted at just $29 31 years later at a poorly received Jams reboot. Waxman changed the menu weekly, sometimes daily, an ongoing, unpredictable Jams session by the one-time musician and innate improviser, the only problem being that the maestro operated on his own wavelength, sometimes changing up the set list at the last possible second. Ferdig remembers it as a free-for-all. One morning, Waxman blew into the kitchen minutes before lunch service and proclaimed, "It's Beaujolais Nouveau Day. Everything has Beaujolais in it." Never mind that all the food for the planned menu had already been prepped, and guests would be filing in any minute. Sometimes Waxman went too far, like the time he tried grilling live lobsters. They, understandably, began crawling off the grate, requiring the cooks to cage them. Some found the spontaneity stimulating, others maddening. Eric Bromberg, who became chef of Jams during its run, remembers that at the outset of each week, Waxman gave him a typed menu to realize by Friday. Often, it was a puzzle to be solved. There was no description on anything, just the names of the dish and a couple of cryptic, sort of weird things. One of them was onion surprise. That's how it was written. Here's the menu. Go make all the food and start the new menu on Friday. It's like 3 days out, and I have no idea what he has in mind.
Chordick, who took over the kitchen a few months after opening when Tingle left, says,
"Jonathan used to write up a menu every day, and we would get it all prepped. And 45 minutes before service began, he would change it. It was painful. I would tell the cooks, even if you're not ready, look like you're ready. Because it was an open kitchen.